But Bodhicharya Avatara is a big text. So at the moment, I'm feeling slightly trepidatious in trying to kind of overview or summarise it. But I'll do my best. So what I'm going to do this morning is kind of draw out some of the central themes of the text of the material, which then Rajasar and I will be going into in more detail in the coming days. So don't expect it all to be answered this morning. In fact, don't expect it all to be answered over the course of a whole week. In a way, one of the things I feel most interested about in exploring this material together is an opportunity to get into some of the core questions that this text raises. As a collective explosion, there's a lot of life experience, there's a lot of experience of practicing the Dharma in this room. So it's an opportunity for us to really say, okay, so what does this mean? How is this relevant to our lives? So that's my hope for the retreat, really. So I'm not expecting to tell you what it's all about, really. And I'm sure I speak for much so as well. What we're really hoping for is to create a mood of exploration, of questioning. Well, how is this relevant to us here and now? So with that said, let's do a little bit of an overview, particularly just to help us all get a sense of what we're talking about. So let's start with why is the Bodhicharya Avatara important? Why are we talking about it? So I suppose, for me, I remember the first time I came across this for Bodhicharya Avatara, relatively early on in my Buddhist life, and it definitely filled a hole. And the hole that I was feeling was you had the kind of the historical teachings of the Buddha, which I experienced as so kind of dry, so kind of fast. You know, you read them and particularly type like the Dhammapada or Vyudana or whatever, you read them and they're gone so quickly. You're like, gosh, what was he even saying there? And somebody gained enlightenment upon reading this, and I just don't know what to make of it. So they felt dry, too fast, too short. Then you've got kind of like high Mahayana sutras of the White Lotus Sutra and so forth, which just seemed so, what the hell has this got to do with me? And so kind of big and unwieldy. Then you've got the teachings of Sangharakshita, which felt very kind of immediate and accessible, but of course spoken by a contemporary person. You know, personally, I met and at least lived in the common in our time. So what the Bodhicharya Avatara represented for me was a set of teachings which were definitely those of you who've already looked at this text, I'm sure you will agree. You can hear the voice of wisdom very directly coming through these words, through these pages. There's an immediacy, there's a directness to it, which I really love. With also having a vastness of vision and possibilities, which really kind of opened my heart. And for me, in that respect, it felt like, obviously I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Buddhist tradition, but for me it definitely holds a special place in my heart for that reason, this sort of both in a vastness of vision and an immediacy of do this, you might not like it, but it'll be good for you, which personally, particularly as a relatively young and unintegrated man, I really enjoyed that sort of that immediacy, that directness. So in some ways, that's why we're doing this, because when we were talking about what to do, I said, let's do the Bodhicharya Avatara, and Mahasaya was kind enough to agree. And in some ways, you could say, well, these qualities which I've just described, well, of course, they've spoken to other people down throughout Buddhist history, which is why it's seen as such a central text. And the Buddhist tradition, nobody really knows, but the suggestion is that in the high Mahayana period of Indian Buddhism, which lasted about 1,000 years, there were hundreds of commentaries on this text. So, you know, people talked about it, people were interested, people engaged, they were like, there was something here, there was something they were interested in. So that's why we're talking about it. So what is it for first? What is it for Bodhicharya Avatara does? Well, what I'd like to suggest is that there's an unusually high number of avenues of human interest which Shantideva successfully evokes. And if he did one or two of them, he'd be doing well. But the fact that he does so many is why I believe is so so significant. So let's start with vision. So the Bodhisattva ideal, this vision of not just addressing our own, the challenges, the suffering, the difficulty in our own lives, but decisively contributing to the well-being, not just of our friends, our families, but of all living beings throughout time. So that's quite a high ideal. And Shantideva seems to really crisply and strongly evoke that. Immeasurable merit took hold of a well-intentioned person who thought, let me dispel the headaches of beings. What then of a person who longs to remove the unequalled agony of every single being and make their virtue infinite? Whose mother or father ever has such a desire for their welfare as this? What deities or sages or Brahmas have it? Those beings did not conceive this desire before, even for their own sake. Even in a dream, how could they have it for the sake of others? So this is, in a sense, this is the heart of the Bodhicaryavatara, this this really strong evocation of a vision of contributing to the well-being of the world, making a difference. And, maybe that's enough to say about that. There's something, I particularly like that particular verse, because it brings home the bigness of what we're talking about, doesn't it? You know, like, it's easy to say, oh yeah, for the welfare of all beings, what does that even mean? But this idea of, like, whoever even just imagined ending headaches, which is a relatively small thing, isn't it? That's what I like about it. But headaches definitely suck. I'm sure we've all had one. We know we don't like them. If somebody said, here's a drug which was meant for you never had a headache again, and in fact I'm going to roll it out to that entire human race, there would be unimaginable rejoicing at that contribution of alleviation of human suffering. So in a way, that's what... what would it be like to imagine the ending of headaches for us, for all beings? And then he goes on to evoke this word, and even our parents, who, you know, I'm sure in many of our cases, all of our cases, loved us, cared for us, even they didn't think that was possible. So what would it be like to say, let's do this, let's reduce the suffering, let's eradicate suffering? So that's Shantideva's first kind of decisive contribution to the discussion, is a real evocation of a vision of alleviating suffering. But he's got more to say about than that. So he's also got, scented out by the trappers, the defilements, you have walked into the trap of birth. Do you not realise even now that you have entered the mouth of death? You do not see those of your own herd as they are killed one by one. You even go to sleep like a buffalo at the butcher. When Yama, Lord of Death, is sizing you up, and at every turn the way is blocked. How can it please you to eat? How can you sleep? How make love? Even if you abandon your sloth as death is swiftly approaching, his implements prepared, it will be too late. What will you do? So as a young man, this evocation of urgency, of the need to act, really spoke to me, really said, this is important, this matters. And of course, you can, there's a correlation between the two, isn't there? For vastness of a vision, of the sense of possibility, naturally correlates with a sense of, well, what are you going to do about that? In a couple of days' time, Maitreya will be kind of evoking this more fully when we're talking about the chapters on mindfulness, where it's a real, very, very strongly evoked sense of urgency, the preciousness, the urgency of this human life. What are we going to do with our limited time? What are we going to do in the face of death, to put it most bluntly? So it's funny, isn't it, thinking about which aspects of this text excite us and which we find challenging. But I suppose, speaking personally, I would have to say that I think, in a way, we'll see as the week goes on, I might find other parts challenging more and more deeply, but this evocation of urgency, of the inevitability of death, is definitely something which, well, I definitely do what he says we shouldn't do. He says, you're going to die and you don't think about it. It's like, yep, I definitely don't think about it. It's like, ping. The amount of time I waste, I suppose, it's if I look at my own kind of Dharma life, I think that's the biggest challenge I face personally, is the extent to which I waste my time. Of course, as you all know, I'm fortunate in a sense, because I work for a Buddhist center, I have, that gives me the time to waste in a certain sense, because I can do work and Buddhism at the same time. Whereas most of you have to do work and then you do Buddhism, which then means that you that fills your life, whereas I'm doing both at the same time, so then I've got all this free time to waste, which is unfortunate. It would be good if I did less of that. Yeah, but there's something about this evocation of urgency, and again, the passion that comes through with that. I'll say a bit more about that a little bit later on. So we've got vision, we've got urgency. May the regions of hell become glades of delight, with lakes scented by a profusion of lotuses, splendid and delightful with a chorus of song from grey geese, ducks, chakravakas, swans and other water birds. Let the heap of hot coals be a heap of jewels, and let the red hot earth be a crystal mosaic, and the crushing mountains of hell become celestial palaces of worship filled with sukkha. Let the rain of burning coals, heated rocks and daggers, from this day forth be a shower of flowers, and let the warring with these weapons, one against the other, now be merely playful, a tussle with flowers. So we have vision and we have urgency, but Shantideva's also got poetry, the beauty of ideas, of images, of expressions, which I think is what, in a sense, is what allows him to speak with such vividness, such force. I've never really experienced fire and brimstone preaching, but this, in a way, this is as closest that Buddhism gets to it. And if it was just kind of like shouting, you're going to hell, well, we wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be talking about this. But somehow, Shantideva has such a beautiful imagination. But rather, although as I say, this can be challenging, particularly when he talks about hell, rather than kind of go, get out of it, it's like there's a beauty of his imagination which opens the heart, which evokes a sense of possibility, a wonder. This text is often described as a work of poetry, as well as a work of kind of spiritual teaching. I feel no anger towards bile and the like, even though they cause intense suffering. Why am I angry with the sentient? They too have reasons for their anger. As this sharp pain wells up, though unsought for, so, though unsought for, wrath wells up against one's will. A person does not get angry at will, having decided, I shall get angry. Nor does anger well up after deciding, I shall well up. Whatever transgressions and evil deeds of various kinds there are, all arise through the power of conditioning factors, while there is nothing that arises independently. Neither does the assemblage of conditioned factors have the thought, I shall produce, nor does what is produced have the thought, I am produced. The much sought for primal matter or the imagined self, even that does not come into being after deciding, I shall become. Since what has not arisen does not exist, who would then form the wish to come into existence? and since it would be occupied with its sphere of action, it cannot attempt to cease to exist either. If a self is eternal and without thought processes, then it is evidently inactive like space. Even in contact with other conditioning factors, what activity can there be of something which is unchanging? So, so we've got vision, we've got urgency, we've got poetry, but we also have philosophy. So here, Shantideva is quite, what he's trying to do is examine the philosophically unsustainable position of a permanent and unchanging self, which is one of, well, again, we'll be saying more about this later on in the week, but I suppose for the time being, this is a core philosophical issue which has perplexed humanity for most of the existence of our species. The desire for certainty, the existence of certain, of fixed and unchanging factors or not, and all of this. So he's not only is he speaking in poetry, he's also really directly addressing the key philosophical concerns of humanity. And again, like I definitely don't have a familiar enough understanding of all the different Buddhist philosophers throughout time, but certainly if you look at his how his work was greeted in the aftermath of that, he's seen as a key figure in the philosophical development of Mahayana Buddhism as well. So it's quite an array of achievements, isn't it? Vision, urgency, poetry, philosophy. Maybe that's why people have been talking about this book for 1,200 years. So we've just got one more. When one notices that one's mind is attracted or repelled, one should neither act nor speak, but remain like a block of wood. When the mind is inflated or derisive, full of arrogance and vanity, exceedingly jocose, evasive or deceiving, when seeming to advance oneself, it is only depreciating others. Contemptuous and scornful, one should remain like a block of wood. My mind seeks acquisitions, reverence or renown, or again wants an audience and attention. Therefore, I remain like a block of wood. My mind longs to hold forth, averse to the good of others, seeking my own advantage, longing only for a congregation. Therefore, I remain like a block of wood. So in a way, this for me completes full circle. So we also have this, it's a particular phrase which I remember somebody using once, which I really liked, reckless self-revelation. So Shantideva's, he's not just kind of coming out with highfalutin philosophy, he's not just coming out with pretty words, he's also saying, this is what my mind is like, this is what I do. And here you go, I'm an open book. The discomforting embarrassment, particularly like that bit. Maybe this is just me, given my character, but just put my page. My mind longs to hold forth, averse to the good of others, seeking my own advantage, looking only for a congregation. Well, maybe you can't identify with that, but certainly I feel Shantideva's like he's pointing at himself, but he's also pointing at me. And I welcome that. I welcome that challenge, the challenge to examine what it is that I do with my own mind, the kind of the dark and hidden places of our own minds. And obviously the purpose of this isn't self-flagellation, it's not to give ourselves a hard time, it's just to recognise this is causing me suffering, this causes other people suffering. So there you have it, there's for me, well, five really good reasons why humanity thinks that this is worth listening to. There's vision, there's urgency, there's poetry, there's philosophy, and there's personal revelation and transformation. It's like, because it's not just self-revelation in the sort of like, look at me, I'm a horrible wretch, aren't I terrible? It's like, look at the ways in which I create suffering for myself and other people, and through exposing that, by acknowledging it to myself and other people, may I discover the courage and the conviction to do something about it, and here's some helpful tips for what you can do next. May I be like a block of wood. So, and you could say that we're going to spend the rest of the week just bathing in, just allowing Shantideva's words to activate these different parts of our psyches, speak to different parts of us. And of course, so I think the reason I wanted to start here is because I'm completely confident that at least some of those will be relevant to all of you. So some people, like the whole poetry thing, like I'm not really one for poetry, I must admit, but this I don't find so bad. But it's like, but maybe some of you say, oh God, will you just stop being so flipping flowery and all of this kind of devotional stuff? But you've got the philosophy, you've got the transformation, you've got, look at your mind. Some of you will find this, the evocations of urgency, a bit much, and it's like, oh God, just push that away a bit. But then, the beauty of the images, the evocation of possibility kind of softens and warms that and allows us to hear that. So that's why I think Shantideva is such a crucial figure in Buddhist history. It's not just, obviously, you know, like in a way, just as I've been preparing for this, it's like, all of the other people point to similar things, but for me it just crystallised as a particularly clear set of qualities. But who was Shantideva? Where did he come from? Why are we here? What are we talking about? So to tell the story in reasonably concise form, so we have a reasonable level of confidence of when Shantideva was alive, so it was somewhere between 675 and 762 or something like that. Mid-sixes to mid-sevens. The reason we know that is because a famous Chinese kind of pilgrim went to Nalanda, the major monastic city university, in 675, and he didn't talk about Shantideva, and seeing that everyone else has been talking about him ever since, we can be fairly confident that he wasn't there at that time, because Hung Swung wrote very extensive kind of travel letters back, which is why we know so much about that period of Buddhist history. And then in 763 or whenever it is, one of Shantideva's disciples went to Tibet and took the Bodhicharyavatar with him and started really strongly propagating it all across Tibet with massive impact. So it obviously must have existed by then, because by then people were talking about it. So it's about an 80-year period in between where nobody quite knows where it came into being. So there's a few stories, and most of you will be familiar with it, but I think it's worth just evoking into the room, really. So the hagiographies, hagiography is a technical term which means the lives of saints, which is, they're always over the top and very kind of, we don't talk about the critical bits. So the hagiography would have that Shantideva was born as a rich Indian prince to a good king, and he was a deeply devout Buddhist practitioner, and he knew loads about Buddhism, and he had a very strong connection with Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. When his dad died, he had a dream, the night before his coronation, where Manjushri was sitting on his father's throne. And Manjushri effectively said to him, I can't quite remember what the quote is, he said, we can't share this throne. We shouldn't share this throne. And Shantideva, who was then called Shantivarman, took that as a evocation of the need to take his Buddhist practice further and not get involved in the work, business of kingship. So he headed over to Nalanda, which at that time was this, it's one of the great centres of learning of the world. It's like tens of thousands of Buddhist scholars and practitioners living together. Huge site. You can go and see some of it today. It's near Bodh Gaya. Unfortunately, it was burned to the ground, and the stories say that the library burned for a year because there were so many books, that's a long time for something to be on fire. So he showed up in Nalanda, and this is where... I'm doubtful about the hagiography, frankly, because then he becomes a nobody, and he gets this reputation as the lazy guy who eats, sleeps, and goes to the toilet, and that's what everyone calls him. They've got this Boku Shu or something like that, which is his kind of like his nickname. So he just becomes like an underground figure who everyone disrespects. Personally, I don't believe that, because it's like, well, if you were the son of a king, you show up somewhere and you don't, everybody doesn't ignore you because you're a person of influence and power and a road to riches. But anyway, that's how the story goes. So anyway, but he's in a position of disrespect, which I do think is true. I do think it's probably true. So I think he wasn't a son of a king. Obviously, who am I to say? But that's what I think. And so he's kind of going around, and so the story goes is basically Nalanda was just a noisy, bickery, full of noise place. So basically he slept through the day and he practiced at night, because that's when it was quiet, that's when there was peace, which is why everybody said all you do is eat, sleep and poo. So one day all of the other monks get together in a bit of a conniving, kind of bitchy mood, frankly, I sort of imagine Nalanda is a bit like the bad side of public school, not that I ever went to public school, but that sort of atmosphere. It's like the in crowd and the out crowd. So basically the in crowd are like, let's show up for cast out, which I imagine many of us can relate to. So they say, okay, tomorrow you're going to, everybody took turns to give speeches, so tomorrow you're going to give the speech. He's like, oh, okay. And then, so he has a night, then he gets up in the morning, and he goes to give a talk. And they've decided to further add to the humiliation, so they don't just have a seat like this. They've piled a load of cushions on the seat, so it's like it's on this massive throne. And they're all like, ha ha ha, he's not going to be able to even take his seat to speak to us. Then he walks up, and he sort of magically, he's on the throne. And they're like, okay, that's weird. And then he says, and this is a very traditional kind of Indo-Tibetan, Tibetan format, he says, do you want to listen to something old or something new? So some of them think, aha, now let's really stitch him up, let's say something new. But some of the others are already thinking, hang on a sec, why are you even giving us that choice? And they're starting to think, what's going on here? Anyway, as we all know, because we're here 1,200 years later talking about it, he proceeds to not embarrass himself and mouth about of meaningless drivel, but just, so the story goes, kind of proclaim the wholeness of this text in just one continuous recitation, which, like, I have listened to it read aloud, and it took quite a few hours over a number of days, to do it in one go is definitely a thing. And so the story goes, as the teaching goes on, particularly as he gets to the most rarefied and kind of, philosophically and spiritually profound aspects of the teaching, he kind of raises up into the air, goes into the clouds, and his voice kind of booms down into the audience, and then he disappears because they're all a bunch of lightweights and aren't serious about Buddhism anyway. So the hagiography continues and has it that he then proceeds to be like a Buddhist superman, kind of going all over, mainly southern India, giving teachings and kind of defeating devils and all of this, that and the other. But really, nobody knows. So, but there is another story of Shantideva, which, again, I don't particularly like, but just, in a way, just I think it's good to see that the picture's always more complex. So there's a tradition called the Mahasiddhas, which are these sort of like crazy wisdom types. And in that tradition, Shantideva's recognised in that tradition, but in that tradition he wasn't a good bloke. He really did just eat, sleep and poo. And the night when he had to give the teaching, he just stayed up all night praying to Manjushri, saying, Manjushri, I'm a total slacker. I've never done any work. Help. And Manjushri blessed him and he gave the teaching. I don't like that story. So I believe it is a human being rather than divine influence. But there you go. For the sake of completeness. Oh, good. Gosh, let's get on with it. Yeah, so the reason we're talking about Shantideva is because he's got these... I'm going to boil it down even more. I think he's got two key themes. Really, I just like reading you verses of his work, which... So we've got the theme of the bodhicitta of transforming the mind so that it is concerned for the well-being of others. So too, I myself shall generate the awakening mind for the welfare of the world, and just so shall I train in those precepts in due order. The wise ones who have taken up the awakening mind with a serene confidence in this way should continue to encourage their resolve as follows in order to fulfil this wish. Today my birth is fruitful, my human life is justified. Today I am born into the family of the Buddha, now I am the Buddha's son. So that there may be no blemish upon this spotless family, I must now act as becomes my family. As a blind man might find a jewel in heaps of rubbish, so too this awakening mind has somehow appeared in me. This is the elixir of life, born to end death in the world. This is the inexhaustible treasure, alleviating poverty in the world. So it's this, it's an evocation of the possibility of leading a profoundly and deeply meaningful life. I suppose, and obviously given the propensity of nihilism within our society, within our world, for sense, all these different kind of contemporary views, but the views that were just, consciousness is an epiphenomena of mind, the views that we're just kind of like biological computers acting out our conditioning, all of these kind of contemporary views, just the view that life doesn't really matter, it doesn't mean anything. I think this evocation that life can mean something, there is a purpose, there is a possibility to our lives. That is just very, very kind of quite important, beautiful, crucial. But how are we going to do that? What is it? How do we lead a meaningful life? What is it that we need to do? The calamities which happen in the world, the sufferings and fears, many as they are, they all result from clinging onto the notion of self. So what good is this clinging of mine? If one does not let go of clinging of self, one cannot let go of suffering, as one who does not let go of fire cannot let go of burning. Therefore, in order to allay my own suffering and to allay the suffering of others, I devote myself to others and accept them as myself. Hey mind, make the resolve. I am bound to others. From now on, you must have no other concern than the welfare of beings. So we've got, on one hand, we've got the vision, a life of meaning, the possibility of transformation, and the other hand, the crucial evocation of what it is that we need to do. A decisive shift away from self-preoccupation and a profound transformation in consciousness, to see that actually the more closely and tightly we grasp after our own well-being, our own happiness, the more it just doesn't work, the more it slips through our fingers. So, of course, that is challenging, isn't it? And in a way, one of the crucial things we're going to be trying to do over the course of this week is, we need to counter the nihilism within our own society. Many of us, particularly, either have or had, when we started practicing, a very strong tendency to self-criticism, self-reproach, thinking that we're not good enough, very, very negative attitude to self. So there's a real danger of this discourse that when Shanti Deva says, I'll stop being concerned with myself, that just reinforces all of those negative tendencies of our own minds to think we're no good, to think that we don't count. So it's really important to remember, when Shanti Deva is saying, I will be concerned for all beings, that includes us. We are part of all beings. So it's not, So it's just really important to remember that, particularly when those kinds of lines trigger this sort of like, oh yeah, I'm no good, or all of that. It's like, well, in a way, this is why the metta-bhavana is so important. For metta-bhavana, it's we transcend preoccupation with self, not through denigrating or destroying the self, but by loving and accepting it, and by expanding love. That's the crucial message. We expand love outwards, not deny love for ourselves. It is worth saying that sometimes he does say some really extreme things about self-cherishing, but it's important to understand that you can only say that if you're starting from a point of self-acceptance, and you need to get to self-acceptance before you can start kind of battering yourself. Some of it, you'll enjoy, those, particularly those of you like Fire and Brimstone, you'll really enjoy some of the later bits because he does go quite extreme. Yep. How are we doing? Yeah, good. So, yeah, so in some ways, just to further emphasise that point, it's really important to remember that Buddhism generally, this text specifically, Buddhism isn't interested in metaphysics. It talks the language of metaphysics. It uses metaphysics a lot, but it's not interested in metaphysics. What it's interested in is pragmatism. So whenever Shantideva is saying something, he's saying it for a pragmatic reason. He's not establishing a set philosophical position. Buddhism is interested in pragmatics, not metaphysics. So, I can't emphasize that enough, because otherwise, he takes off on a load of stuff like this, particularly as a man's writing for a male audience. He does a whole piece about sexual desire, which if you took that as metaphysics, you'd conclude that he had some really twisted ideas about women, cute bodies, and people. And he's not establishing a metaphysical position. It's purely a pragmatic tool to counter his the force of craving in his own mind. Very, very important to understand that. And as I say, especially with regard to hell, so one of the things which really struck me this time reading through this material is the frequency and the repeatedness with which he refers to hell. Which, of course, that's interesting, isn't it? In a post-Christian culture, some of us having had quite strong Christian conditioning in our childhood, some of us that being not very present at all. But nonetheless, all of us living in a post-Christian, in a Christian and post-Christian society, we obviously have a lot of understandings about, we've got a lot of culturally imported understandings of what hell means, what hell is. So just to make it really clear from the off, but for crucial things is hell isn't in the Buddhist conception. Buddhism does talk about hell, but of course, Buddhism's saying is that our minds create our experiences. So I'm sure we've all have experienced or seen people having hellish experiences of constriction, of malice, of loss, of blackness, of really vile and unpleasant mental states. So what Buddhism is saying is that you're not being punished. Nobody's punishing you when you're experiencing those states. Those experiences just are hellish. It's purely pragmatic. It's like, it is hellish to feel like that. So let's call it hell. And of course, Buddhism goes further than that. As we all know, it does. Buddhism talks the language of multiple lives and the fact that our consequences, the actions of our consequences, will have repercussions in the future. And maybe that just takes place in the course of one lifetime, and maybe that takes place over the course of multiple lives. I think that's one of the central questions that modern Buddhism needs to explore. And I suppose, as I've said to some of you before, for myself, I find it perplexing. So intellectually, I read accounts of rebirth. I'm not talking about hell specifically, but I read accounts of rebirth. And intellectually, I just think they totally make sense. I think, yeah, you can't... How else do you want to describe all of these kinds of experiences? Children remembering past lives, near-death experiences, and what's the other one? Hypnotic regression. There's such a body of multiple accounts of people having experiences which you can't explain in any other way. People speaking ancient Spanish, which when people say, "What are you speaking?" they have to go and get a medieval Spanish, or is it French, linguist, and they're saying, "Oh, you're speaking medieval French. I've never heard anyone speak it before, but I recognise it." How else do you want to explain some 1970s housewife from Nebraska being able to speak medieval French? she wasn't remembering it from past life. Just as an example, there's so much. And yet, when 2 years ago, when my grandparents died, I was presented with the fact that actually, like, looking at this person who's dead, I have got absolutely no idea what's happened, and I really don't know what I think. So that's interesting, isn't it? So on, like, on an abstract intellectual position, I'm convinced. In terms of actually, when somebody dies, what do I think happened? You know, Sangharakshita's death last year, what do I think happened to his consciousness? I've got no idea. So it's a mystery. It's a mystery. So it's pragmatic, not metaphysics. And Buddhism does use the language of hell very strongly. And in a way, it's a pragmatic position, just saying, take the consequences of our actions seriously. In a way, we'll be evoking this, in a way, you could say, boiling it down even further, that's a primary invitation for Bodhicaryavatara, take your actions seriously. So hopefully I've evoked something of the vastness, of the poetry, of the story. I just want to say a few more bits and then we'll finish. So first of all, I think, personally for me, one of the things that I find really attractive about the Bodhicaryavatara is that I do have a tangible sense of one person talking. So often with Buddhist literature, you've got this sense, it's like it's a composite text with like chapters arising from different places. In this, it's like this is one person, one man's voice speaking down the years. And there's something about that I find very, very compelling. One of the questions I ask myself a lot, particularly in the context of puja, is like, what would it be like to be this person? What would it be like to see the world as he saw the world? In a way, we have that invitation with the visual arts, don't we? I think of Rembrandt's Starry Night, and in a way, the invitation of that image is like, what would it be like to see the world in those ways? And in a way, that Shantideva is giving us an invitation, the opportunity. What would it be like to see the world through his eyes? Well, in some ways, what it would be like, it would be to be an inspired genius, because that's what he is. Just a genius who's got a real vision. But I think it's important just to have a sense of his humanity. I think, because maybe you're feeling a bit intimidated or a bit daunted by the breadth of what we're talking about. So again, this is a personal reflection about the life of Shantideva. But one of the things which has been really striking me again as I've been reading it this week is that he was lonely. He was lonely. He was isolated. Nothing new will be said here, nor have I any skill in composition. Therefore, I do not imagine that I can benefit others. I have done this to perfume my own mind. While doing this, the surge of my inspiration to cultivate what is skillful increases. Moreover, should another of the very same humours as me also look at this, then he too may benefit from it. So you could say that's quite extreme. There's a degree of conscious countering arrogance and a conscious practice of humility there. But I think also what comes through this is he was lonely, he was isolated, like he was just this guy who everybody else teased and wasn't interested in. That's a painful place to be. It's a lonely place to be. You can see that throughout this text again and again, his friends are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. He's got a rich and vivid life of relationship on the archetypal level, but he doesn't have effective human relationships. All his conversation about human relationships is predicated upon dysfunctional relationships. So in some ways, I'm seeking to encourage optimism here. We've got a reasonably effective range of relationships which can help us transform our minds. We can talk to each other. You know, when he says, "I don't think anybody else thinks like me," well, we can check this out. We can talk to each other. We can say, "Oh, so what happens for you when you get?" When you want to aggrandize yourself, when you want everyone to listen to you and think that you're the best. How does that work for you? What's it? And when I do this, can you tell that I'm doing that? So we've got a tremendous advantage and opportunity here within the practice of Sangha. But of course, he's also a genius. Let embodied beings hear, unwearied, the sound of the Dharma, from winged birds, from every tree, from every light ray, and from the sky. So as I really love that, that sense of vision that we can transformation, possibility, ever openness of moment, every moment and every awareness, it can be everywhere, and that's the world, that's the vision he's inviting us to live in. So what I want, so I've got the questions I'd encourage us to invite, to reflect, invite us to reflect on, discuss, explore our meaning. What is it? What is a meaningful life? What does it mean for you? Where do you find meaning in your lives? Urgency, what is it that motivates you? How do we keep that urgency in mind? And this radical transformation from self-obsession to altruism and the freedom and lightness and peace that that can bring. Those are the Shantideva's gifts to us. Those are Shantideva's gifts to the world. And I really hope that together over the course of this week we can inhabit and explore that world together.